Welcome to Your Music Saved Us, where two friends blast ourselves into the past to relive and recontextualize the alternative Christian music we grew up listening to in the 1990s. I'm Clifton, and I'll be your host today, and joining me is the embodiment of nature itself that will catch up with you for looking down anybody's shirt, Jay. How are you today?
I'm great, Clifton. Thank you for the really thoughtful introduction.
And on that note, what are we listening to?
We are listening to Luxury's, 1995 debut, Amazing and Thank You.
Have you listened to this since the 90s?
Maybe once or twice, and I know we'll talk about it in a minute, but I'll tell you, I watched the documentary recently, okay. Parallel Love, about the band, and then I heard it then, so I don't know if that counts, but okay. Before then, not much.
Okay, so how did going back to it make you feel?
Surprised, I guess. I feel like I didn't give it the chance it deserved back in the 90s. Yeah. Probably also, I'm not sure my teenage brain could comprehend some of this. We'll get into that more. But so there was a lot more there than I realized. Let me put it that way. And it was a really nice thing to discover again.
Yeah, we'll get into it, but agreed. How hard is this to find a listen to?
It was on Spotify, thank goodness. I promise, okay. Listeners, we're not just plugging Spotify. It's just by far the easiest way to listen to music, at least.
If you have a subscription.
Right. Yeah. If you have a smartphone. And so it's really nice when this stuff is on there. But it is on there. True. It's also on Bandcamp, and as is like pretty much everything they've ever done.
Yes. So before we get started here, tell us a little bit about the band.
Okay. So I will kind of give my sources. A lot of this, and if you watch the Luxury documentary, you'll know, comes from that. A lot of this also comes from an issue of Down the Line magazine from January 2011 that is online. And in that, Chris, who is the bass player, he gives a lot of this info. So Luxury began as a band called The Shroud, and they formed, I couldn't tell for sure, but either in 91 or 1992 in Toccoa, Georgia. All the members of the band were students at Toccoa Falls College, which was a small Christian school in Northeast Georgia. Glenn Black, who is the drummer, started there in 1986. And I believe Jamie Bozeman, the guitarist, arrived in 1988. His younger brother, Lee, the singer, arrived in 1990, along with Chris Foley, the bass player. And I believe Glenn, Jamie, and Lee all knew each other a little bit from church back in Michigan, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Chris was the one who was kind of new to the group. But they all had different musical interests. You know, Glenn loved classic rock, Chris loved punk, Jamie's into U2, Lee loved the Smiths. But because Toccoa Falls is such a small Christian school, and I looked it up, by the way, I think it's under 2,000 students, you know, total. Jeez. It was kind of like, oh, you have Doc Martens on? Oh, you have some punk band? Your hair's weird? Like, they became friends because of that. Like, it was just kind of like, oh, all the kind of alternative, different kids met up. Mm-hmm. And so they really brought their musical influences into what started off being called The Shroud. And The Shroud recorded a demo in 1992 called Tinsel, and then recorded a full-length called Candy Darling in 1993. Both these are on Luxury's Bandcamp page. And if you listen to them, they both sound a lot like Luxury already. And one thing I think is interesting about these releases, too, is they also kind of show their kind of graphic design style as well. The same style you'll see in Amazing and Thank You and The Latest and the Greatest, like some of their later albums, you're already seeing in their demos. And stuff that's kind of that throwback to 50s and 60s fashion, and they seemed very intentional about the way they presented themselves, which was interesting. Anyway, back at this time around 93, they opened a small music venue in Toccoa called The Dish, and I got the sense that they really did this more just to allow them to play with a lot of bands. Like, they brought bands to town and kind of made a scene there, but it was also like, oh cool, every band that comes in, Luxury will open for them. Speaking of that, they changed their name to Luxury sometime around this time and recorded then what was called the Pink Tape in 1994. And some of these songs found their way onto the album we're talking about today, Amazing and Thank You.
Is there a reason for changing their name?
You know, I could never get clarity on that. It just seemed like they wanted to kind of shift the direction of the band a little bit. I read at some point they thought about breaking up. They took some time off, and then they realized they looked so forward to playing together. They were going to do like one last show, and they were so looking forward to that and being around each other that they were like, okay, maybe we'll continue. And so I think they just want to take a different direction. And let's be honest, I think Luxury is a much better name than The Shroud, especially for the style of music they're playing. Agreed. So, you know.
Yeah, and the documentary said something about it just fitting the aesthetic better, too. So
yeah, I think so. The Shroud definitely sounds more Christian. I don't know if they meant it to. And just, I mean, that could be a metal band. Like, it just, you don't know what kind of thing you're going to hear with that.
Although Luxury makes it very hard to search when you have songs like Vanity and Champagne.
Agreed.
And Pure Gold.
Even Toccoa, Georgia Luxury brings up luxury cabins and things that you can rent there now. Yes. Anyway. So, summer of 94, they go to Cornerstone. They play the impromptu stage. And from everything I read, it sounds like literally like on the spot immediately after Brandon Ebel with Tooth & Nail Records offers them a record deal. And I think they jump at it just because, like, this is what we've always wanted, a record deal. In November that year, they go to Neverland Studios in Nashville, and they record Amazing and Thank You with Steve Hindelong and Chris Colbert. An album comes out sometime in the spring of 95. Luxury tours on it some. They play Cornerstone that July. Evidently, that Cornerstone performance is one of the best ones they've ever had, you know, because it's so many people that already have the album are there. They're in top form. Everything is great. And then just a couple days later, on their way home from the festival, they have a huge van accident that was like really pretty serious. The van flipped over. I know Lee and Glenn both had severe injuries. They spent a lot of time in the hospital, and I think no one was really sure if the van would go on.
Yeah.
But it did. Not until the next spring, though, they started, you know, writing some new songs, and their next album, The Latest and Greatest, came out in January of 97. So you have to think, you know, you're kind of right at the beginning of your kind of career trajectory as a band. You've just put out this album. It's got a national release. People are paying attention to it. You have a big show at Cornerstone, and then boom, this huge accident that just takes the band completely out of commission for like a year.
Wow.
So I think that set them back in a lot of ways in what they were doing. But they did release their second album, came out in 97. They did do one other tour. They've only done two tours as a band ever, and it seems weird to say. With Morella's Forest, ended up being their last. And I, from what I read, I think it was just the band members were getting older, they're having children, just decided to kind of put it down for a while. They picked it back up in late 98, early 99, and they, at this point, they'd left Tooth & Nail, which we'll probably talk about more in a little bit, and they decided to put out their next album with some friends on the label Bulletproof, you know, which was Grayed Out Records in Georgia, people they knew. They released it in 99. Luxury like has so much bad luck because, unfortunately, from what I understand after this, Bulletproof kind of folds
immediately.
Yeah, has distribution issues. So I saw that Luxury bought up like 1,000 of the CDs from Bulletproof and were selling them on their own on eBay back in the day.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can imagine, like, kind of like you're getting this new start and then boom, this happens. So at this point, I think they kind of put it down. They're no longer touring. They're not doing anything. They do get back together in 2004 and put out a release called Health and Sport on Northern Records in 2005. Then they really take a break and don't do anything until their fifth record, Trophies, comes out in 2000. I think they came out in early 2015. It doesn't get released really, though, until 2019 to coincide with the documentary that just came out, Parallel Love. Oh, and in the meantime, by the way, three of the members now have become Orthodox priests, which is part of what obviously the documentary is about. It's a lot to think about. And I guess one question or one thing to think about as we start, and I know we'll discuss it more, though, is like, is Luxury a Christian band? You know, they say on the documentary, or are maybe they are the most Christian band because they have three of the members are priests. It's really kind of a more than probably any other band we've done to this point. It's really probably something to think about with them because it's, yeah, well, you'll just see as we get into this album if you've never heard it. So
yeah, especially the lyrics and the style and everything. And I think it'll probably do us well to talk about the documentary more after we talk about the album if we want to. But there's one thing that in the documentary that you just mentioned that really puzzles me is that they made a big deal out of being on Tooth and Nail, and that it may have been a mistake going with a Christian label just because it kind of pigeonholed them into this Christian music market where they could have probably done much better outside of it. And then when it came time to put out their third album and they get to choose another record label, they choose Bulletproof. What were they thinking? I don't understand.
Yeah, I did read more about that, and I apologize, I don't know if I have the source anymore, but somewhere they said they actually wanted to go with Velvet Blue Music for that release.
That would have been a good choice.
Still Christian, but much more in that kind of realm. And Jeff Cloud, the owner, wanted to do it, but basically he just didn't have the budget that they needed because they were they basically said, look, we're going to have to do this on the weekends for X number, I think, of even months. This is, you know, so he was just like, I can't, you know, fund that. So, but he went to Bulletproof, which were friends of theirs, and they were like, yep, can do it, which maybe Luxury helped bankrupt Bulletproof. I don't know, but I think that was one reason. But I agree, you would think they would try to angle, but maybe at this point they felt like Tooth and Nail was already the kiss of death on them because of that. I don't know.
Yeah. I just feel like if you have a choice, you might as well say, hey, we're going to make a huge, you know, change in direction. There's plenty of bands who have gone from Christian music to doing secular music around this time, you know, going to Columbia or A&M or things like that. You know, I mean, MXPX, we've already talked about Dakota Motor Company, you know, so I don't know. It just seems like a weird choice to me.
Yeah. And maybe no one else was offering, you know,
maybe.
I know.
But yeah, I don't know. They didn't get into that much in the documentary. So
no,
guess we can't really know. Okay. So when did this come into your life, Jay?
So I think the first time I heard Luxury was on the Artcore Volume 1 compilation. Mm-hmm. And their song on there, When the Curtain Falls, is also on this album. Kind of like a hidden, it's sort of a hidden track. It's hard to decide. To be honest, that was not the most thrilling song for me at the time. It's pretty slow. Yeah.
Why was that the song they put on Artcore?
Great question.
Almost any other song in this would fit on Artcore better.
It's not a bad song, and I like it more now. But for, you know, 14 or 15 year old Jay, however old I was when I heard it, it was definitely like a skip.
Yeah.
But I did get their second album, Latest and Greatest, I think, when it came out. And after that, somehow I got this album on tape. I think I bought one of those, you know, the Christian bookstores had the demo tapes, and I think they were selling them. And so I was like, oh, cool, Luxury, and bought it. And so I have distinct memories of mowing lawns while listening to this on my Walkman.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, my first experience with Luxury was on the Tooth and Nail Rock compilation volume 1, which was 97. So right when the second album came out as well. And that's Metropolitan, which doesn't sound anything like the rest of Luxury. So when I went to look back to listen to more Luxury, I was like, oh, this is... I probably could have liked it if it wasn't such a huge shift in what I'd already heard. You know, if I was not expecting that, it probably would have been a better... I probably would have received it better. I probably still, like you said, would not have fully grasped it or comprehended it, you know, in that time. But it would have been more likely, I think.
Right.
What role did this play in your life back then? What did it mean to you?
You know, I'll be honest. I don't know if it meant too much. I liked their sound. I liked that second album quite a bit. I enjoyed the tape quite a bit of this first album. I really remember like Flaming Youth, Flames On. I think that must have been the first song on the second side of the tape. So for some reason in my mind, that was the first song on this album until I re-listened to it. But I liked it. I thought they were fun. It was good. I didn't have any real, you know, deeper connection to it then.
Okay. So before going back and listening to it, did you have any expectations?
I thought I would probably like it. You know, and again, watching that documentary kind of colored the complete way I saw all this. So, you know, whether that's fair or not, it's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, again, watching that kind of gave me a new lens to look at them through because I knew more of the backstory that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It made it a lot more interesting, honestly. Yeah. It also made me think about them more as a live band, which, you know, they never toured very much, and I never really had a chance to see them. But when you watch the clips in the documentary and you start thinking about these songs live, I had a much greater appreciation for it.
Yeah, when we went back to listen to it, you know, I didn't listen to this back in the day, this album, but I very purposefully, when I was listening to it, I listened to it as loud as I could every time I listened to it, just so I could get the full appreciation of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tried to put on headphones, really, and keep it cranked up and really dive in.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, let's dive into this album. Let's talk about the first track, Pink Revenge.
Yeah, I love the way this starts the album. I think it was a great choice. He kind of starts off with he's clicking the drumsticks. There's a few isolated notes on the guitar, and then just everything comes in all at once. Loud. You can imagine how intense it would be live. Glenn is hitting those drums as loudly as possible. Like, it's you're kind of not sure what this is gonna be.
Yeah.
And then kind of the guitar kind of fades out, and when Lee's voice comes in, I feel like he kind of echoes it, like he kind of comes slowly into it. And when I first heard this in the 90s, I'll say I had never heard the Smiths. But when I listen to it now, I'm immediately reminded of Morrissey. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't miss it in that, especially that beginning of that first song.
Yeah, especially this song.
Yeah, like, it's just clear as day. Like, okay, this is like a real, it seems like a real loud, noisy band with, like, Morrissey singing for them, essentially, is what you feel, you know.
And on the other songs, there's, like, a Morrissey influence, whereas this song is just... sounds like Morrissey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lee doesn't hide that in interviews or anything, that he's a Smiths fan. So that's clearly, you know, what that is. And I felt like even in the delivery of the lyrics, it's kind of Morrissey-like. Like, you know, in some of the Smiths songs, like, it's kind of random how the lyrics are delivered. Sometimes stuff is like, held out. And then sometimes it's just, you know, sang pretty quickly through the verse. And I feel like he does that on this too. It's kind of no rhyme or reason to how he's actually going to sing the lyrics. I know people have kind of said that Luxury is like the Smiths meets Fugazi. And I feel like for this song especially, that's kind of a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, agreed. I will say that kind of raucous beginning is fun, but at the same time, it's very minor chord oriented, which kind of gives it like this like darkness to the song. And I can see very much why teenage Clifton would have been put off by that.
Oh yeah, you wanted more clear cut, like happier sounding.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, but just like, I don't know. I don't know if I wanted more happier sounding, but I think it probably reminded me too much of the heavier music, the hardcore music that was going on at the time, for the first song. Yeah. And really, because this first song is structurally and the way it comes, it's very different from the rest of the songs, I should say. I'll leave it to that.
Yeah.
We'll get into how the other songs are different.
This is one that it was kind of hard to make out the lyrics. Mm-hmm. Like, when I first heard the chorus, I thought it was, "Then it's your love." Which, of course, Christian kid listening to this is automatically going to, like, default to that kind of stuff, right? Like, oh, it's on tooth and nail. I'm sure they're somehow singing about God. And at the end of the chorus, Lee says, you know, ta 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 ta, you know, la 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 la.
Right.
Which I love, especially now listening to it, because it's very confident, it's very sassy, and, like, you can tell this is not a new band. Like, they know what they're doing. They play, like, they're pretty confident on this album, which is really nice. This is not some kind of, you know, brand new band, even though it's their first album for Tooth and Nail.
Which is kind of different for Tooth and Nail, because Tooth and Nail at this point, almost everything on there is really young bands who are recording their first album. And that will stay true for another few years, where a band's around for like a year and they all of a sudden have a contract with Tooth and Nail. Whereas these guys have been around for 4 years or so and have several recordings under them already.
Right. I mean, and even this song is on the demo before that.
Right.
And you can go back and listen to kind of an earlier version of it, which is not drastically different than this. And that's one thing that I think is interesting too, because Thank You Luxury, by the way, because they put their songs on Bandcamp, yes, of all the old demos, you can go back and listen and you realize these songs are pretty well built before they arrive in the studio to record this. So it's not like Steve or Chris, when they're recording the album, actually changed it that much. You know, sometimes producers come in and they do a lot and change the sound. This was like, nope, we're gonna have these songs, we're just gonna record them the way they are. And it works well. You know, getting back in this song, Lee, a couple of other lyrics I've made out, he says, any regrets, I haven't lived my life, you know, and it goes back into the chorus again. The bridge, most of the band fades out while Lee faintly says, ta 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 ta, and then he goofily sings like, la 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 la. Kind of like a kid, and laughs after it, and and then he purrs, and then they jump into the last verse and get loud again. And again, it's like something you definitely were not hearing in Christian music at the time. I don't know how to say it, but it's very kind of sassy and very confident.
Right.
And then I do remember this from hearing it before. The last verse is something like, "You'll never be a lady, no, never be a lady, something, something," is all I could really make out. And then the song ends. And it's pretty short for the songs on this album. It's like 3 minutes, 15 seconds. And I think it's a pretty perfect way to start off the album, really.
There's a video for this song.
Really?
Did you watch the video?
Oh, yeah. No, I missed the video. I'll have to go back and watch it.
It's not super interesting. It's just like some 60s footage of people riding, driving around and stuff like that. But like very suburban, you know, kind of that 60s aesthetic that are already inside, you know. Kind of intermixed with them playing and kind of using like an old film stock probably to get that same look as the 60s footage. It's not bad. You know, I would say of those early Tooth & Nail videos, it's only worse than probably that Starflyer 59 music video. But it's not on any of the Tooth & Nail.
That's okay. Video thank collections. You. I was, because I had all those, and now you say it, I'm like, I don't remember this. So you're like, what was going on with this?
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about what Tooth & Nail wanted to happen with this band.
And it's, you know, again, in the documentary, you watch Brandon and James, who worked at Tooth & Nail, they're talking about this band like they knew they would be the next big thing.
Right.
But then you're wondering, well, why didn't you push
it? Any effort.
Yeah.
Any effort at all.
Now, to be fair, and I looked this up, this is only the 16th release on Tooth & Nail. I mean, this comes out before Joy Electric. This is out before Strong Arm. This is out before some of those bands that you just associate with Tooth & Nail almost from the beginning. So
yeah, this is the first album of 1995. So this is less than a year into the record label.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's super early. Like two releases later is Artcore Volume 1.
Yeah, the only thing really that I think they had on the label that was even similar to this was Starflyer 59 at that point. Like nothing
else.
Yeah,
that's the most similar thing.
Yeah.
And just because we haven't talked about it yet, because there's a very wall of sound. Wall of Sound guitars on this.
Right.
Not for this song, but for the rest of the album.
Well, and so maybe we should just jump to the lyrics on this one, because this might help us know, like, clarify why maybe Tooth & Nail didn't share this video on the compilation, even though, again, I find the lyrics kind of unintelligible in some places on this song, so...
They are.
Some other songs are clear, but, where do we start?
Let's read the first verse and talk about it.
Okay, here, I've got it right here. It says, here's womankind, so delicate, so refined. How conveniently you intrude, but this dress doesn't quite suit you, and your subtle father would faint that it's you.
Maybe we should read the second verse, too.
Okay, all right, here's the second one.
Then let's go back and talk about each verse independently.
Second verse, 13, it shook your world when you first knew. Now it's up with pink and down with blue. Once it was James, now June. Any regrets? I haven't lived my life just yet.
Right.
to so me, that's like really clear.
Yeah, this is about a transgender woman. Right. So back to the first verse. Is the first verse recounting something that happened in childhood? You know, just some kids playing around and one of them puts on a dress and is like, works pretty well for them, you know?
Yeah. This dress doesn't quite suit you. And your subtle father would faint that it's
What you. Is a subtle father?
I guess soft-spoken, you know, or something.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay.
To me, it sounds like something that Morrissey would say, so he put it.
Yes.
He wrote it that way.
That I can 100% believe. Yeah.
But yeah, I think the second verse really clarifies what's going on in this song for sure. Talking about being 13, kind of realizing and going from James to June, I haven't lived my life just yet.
Right.
So. Yeah, I'm just knowing the Christian culture at the time, how in the world this made it through and was on Christian bookstore shelves, and as far as I know, didn't cause a ton of controversy,
right?
It blows my mind.
So I'm thinking back on this, and even though I was an asshole back then, I was probably like a slightly more accepting asshole than most people in the church. But I'm trying to think, like, is the transgender issue a big deal today because it's become part of the culture war and it was less of a big deal in the church back then?
It's a good question. Part of me just thinks this was kind of ahead of its time in a way. Yeah. Not that there weren't people, I don't mean that, dealing with this, but just that it wasn't in the culture as much. And I also wonder if just Christians had no framework to even interpret this. I think most are just like, I don't know what they're talking about. Like kind of,
yeah, thing, that's very possible. Know?
Just
yeah.
kind of like whoop over their heads type deal and move on, you know?
Yeah. And like, cause I can remember, like I remember I guess it was after my freshman year in high school, we went to Chicago on a mission trip and while we were there, one of the regular kind of just people personalities around was what in the verbiage of that time was a crossdresser, but today I would say is a transgender woman. And I always just thought, well, that's who that person is. Like, so you know, like me at this time in the church just saw that person and was just like, that's who that person is.
It's a good point. It's like you haven't been told it's bad.
Right.
Because you have no framework for it. So you're just like, oh, okay.
Right.
Which kind of gets at, it makes you think about a lot of the stuff that you're taught in that culture, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, and just
hate is taught.
Yeah. Like, right. Like, you know, if you just experienced it without any kind of bias,
right.
You can see it as bad. Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's interesting. I watched that. That was one thing the documentary did for me is I watched it and I didn't realize really any of the stuff about Luxury's lyrics because I had this on tape. I wasn't paying attention to the lyrics, wasn't listening, you know. And so to see all that now, I was like, oh my gosh, it was really fun kind of going back and rediscovering all this that completely like went above me when I was listening to it before.
Yeah. And the chorus, I can honestly tell you that listening to it, I never hear the words pink revenge. Do you hear the words pink revenge in the chorus?
Yeah, no.
Okay, I don't think they're there. Like, no one's vocalizing them. I also watched it live, and no one, like, the parts of the song where Pink Revenge would be, according to the lyrics, no one steps up to the microphone.
I'm not sure he's saying it, yeah.
Yeah, no. Okay. I just want to make sure.
That's an interesting title for this song, because, like, revenge in what way? Like, what?
Right, that's one of my big questions.
You know, I like it. I think it's a great title for a song, and but it makes you wonder kind of what's going on.
And it also kind of maybe hints at that the person is being transgender as a revenge against something, which is not a great take.
Well, the third verse says, sometimes it's like a strange little game between two, me and you, but you'll never be a lady, you'll never be a lady, never be a lady, no, not like me. Right. And that's basically how the song ends, like, not like me, you know.
The third verse is the most confusing of any of the lyrics on the album. I don't understand what the strange little game is.
Now,
I do appreciate that you'll never be a lady, not like me. There's some humor in that, right?
One thing I read about them is Lee Well, a couple things. Lee's favorite poem is The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. And, you know, that poem is like, I mean, there's been whole classes taught, like semester-long classes taught on that poem, you know, because there's so many things in it. And it's one of those poems you need, like, a book just to begin to understand it, because almost every line is referencing something else, is pulled from some other place. And so he talks about, he tries to do that a lot with his lyrics, I think, especially early on. So he's pulling stuff from other places sometimes. And then also, he's just admitted sometimes some of it just sounded nice.
Yeah.
So, like, some lines have a lot of meaning, other lines, it just sounded good in the song. So, you know, it's kind of hard to know. But if you'll allow me, I did find a little bit about this song from the source. This is from a 1999 interview from the website The Phantom Tollbooth. And it sheds a little light kind of on what's going on here. And Tollbooth asks, what was it like writing Pink Revenge from a male point of view? And Lee Bozeman says, I think I'm fairly in touch with my feminine side. It's just one of those questions about how do we deal with a person who is so uncertain about their sexuality? I feel like a woman. How do we deal with that? It just deals with that issue. I like to sort of play around with people's minds sometimes. I think it'd be great to be a woman sometimes, in some ways. In some ways, I wouldn't. And Jamie, his brother, says, no way, man. And Lee says, I'm not afraid of that. I'm pretty secure in my maleness and play around with all that. All the great rock and roll guys were always really androgynous. David Bowie and Morrissey to an extent, Marilyn Manson, you know, this androgyny kind of runs everywhere. Jamie says, I think they've kind of gotten away from that lyrically, but I think that a lot of it's maturing because it's just a period for us. What we were listening to kind of had a lot to do with that kind of thing. Bowie and Mark Bolan, kind of borderline people who played around with, am I a boy or am I a girl? But they really knew what the mystery was. Could you figure it out? That's probably part of it, too. And that probably made sense for us to start off an album with it. Just us being stupid. The funny thing about it is that we never really thought about it, but looking at Christian music, especially at that period of time, bands weren't doing that. We were the only ones who ever really did that. Maybe Mike Knott did some weird stuff like that. Maybe Scattered Few. Maybe someone like that. And Tollbooth asks, so you don't write these things for shock value? Lee says, I probably do sometimes. And Jamie says, In a way, you want to balance it out. You want to provoke a response, but the idea of us provoking response, but part of it is to make you think. I think we tend to try to make people think, but a lot of times we're accused of being not Christian enough. But in a lot of ways, we're going to be a lot better for the Christian public than a lot of bands out there that they're listening to. And Tolbu says, any band that's going to make you question what you believe is going to come under fire. Lee says, definitely. And Jamie says, it's very important too. Not to mention in order to make you doubt and turn away, but to question to make you doubt and then rethink what you're doing and to strengthen yourself. So I think that kind of clarifies. It sounds like he was just thinking a lot about this. Lee also put out a book recently with a lot of the lyrics and kind of explanations, and it's got the chords for the songs if you want to play them with the guitar and stuff. And in that book, he says, you know, we were trying to sound like Shudder to Think, and everything was always an imitation. I was thinking a lot at the time about gender issues, men and women, men being women. It seemed so simple at the time. So there you go. But again, how this slipped through the little censors at Christian music stores, and the fact that Roadside Monuments, you know, second album had that first song, Sperm Ridden Burden, and a lot of stores wouldn't carry it because of that, yet this made it through, surprises me.
I mean, it probably literally just went under the radar.
I think that must have been what it was, for sure. Yeah.
And I think part of the simplicity there is just that it hadn't become a culture war.
I think you're right.
You know?
It wasn't a real thing yet, so people were kind of like, just like you said, like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and I want to be clear about what I mean by it hadn't become a culture war yet. I mean that Christians hadn't got their panties in a wad and decided to hate people that aren't like them.
Thank you for the clarity, Clifton.
No problem.
Well, you want to talk about the next song?
Yeah, let's move on to South.
Yeah.
But you can't, another song you cannot Google. Luxury South, not a Googleable term.
Yep. This has been a struggle on some of these, episodes. So South kind of starts with a tambourine over what kind of sounds like an organ before the drums and kind of guitar come in.
It's just feedback, though.
Okay. Well, it's a nice sounding feedback.
It is.
And this song, it kind of locks into like a groove almost. It's kind of driven by the bass line. And they play for almost like a minute before the vocals enter. And it's interesting. This one is much more clear as far as being able to understand what he's saying. And the first thing he says is, "I've got the world on a string." And then he says, "These are the last words I will ever sing," which I think are both actually references to other songs. Like, "I've got the world on a string" is from Frank Sinatra. And then, "These are the last words I will ever sing" is very similar to not a Smiths, but a Morrissey song. On one of his albums. So, you know, stealing stuff. But, you know, one thing you hear in this song, especially if you listen to it loud, is Glenn plays a really ridiculous drum fill before the first verse. Not something you normally hear in like kind of indie rock, and you could tell he's got like he really likes classic rock and stuff. And for some reason on this album, when he does that, it doesn't, to me at least, it's not annoying. You know, sometimes the drums can be too loud and too much, and you're like, okay, a little too much for this style of music. But I guess they've just mixed it right where it's, if you're listening for it, you notice it, but otherwise you're like, okay, yeah,
it fits. And one thing we haven't talked about is that this is the first Wall of Sound song.
Yeah.
It is just, it starts that tambourine, a little bit of feedback, like Jay said, and then it's just Wall of Sound for 5 minutes and 14 seconds, whatever it is, something like that. Yeah.
And that's, I put that in my notes too. You really have to imagine this live, like so loud, but with his voice, it's kind of just like crooning above it. Like, it's not really shoegaze, but it's kind of got that like, loud Wall of Sound aspect to it, you know?
That same step away from shoegaze that Starflyer takes, this is one more step in that direction, where it is Wall of Sound, but it's not shoegaze.
Right. Yeah. It moves into a bridge later. It's kind of start-stoppy at the beginning, and then it's got this really noisy guitar solo. I don't know if it... I know, Clifton, you have kind of guitar solos you like. I don't know if this is one that you...
That was fun. Guitar solo is a loose term for it, but it's a very indie rock kind of guitar solo, though, where it's just they're making noise and having fun, and it fits with the Wall of Sound, you know, aesthetic, I think, that and it all comes off really great to me. I try to find this song live, which is why I was trying to search the word Luxury South, but I couldn't find anything, because this is probably the song I would like to see live.
Yeah,
partially just because it had to be amazing, like without Wall of Sound, and secondly, because I was trying to figure out how they did the guitar solos with only Lee sometimes playing guitar, and then, is it Chris on guitar?
Jamie
on guitar.
Bass, yeah.
Okay. And then Jamie playing guitar, where he's probably the one doing the solo, I assume, not Lee. I don't know. But I was just curious how they pulled it off. But it's because it's just, there's so much noise going on that I don't know how, to me, it would take more than two guitars to make that much noise.
Yeah, it's a fun song. You know, lyrically, this one is, I mean, it's a mystery, but I don't think it's as much, you know, it's not as much maybe to dig into as the first song. But, you know, he starts off with, here's the way I interpret it, and Clifton, maybe you took this differently. The first line is, "I've got the world on a string," and then he says, "These are the very last words that I will ever sing, and is that such a casual way to end my very last day? Please tell me." So I interpret it as, Oh, the last words I ever sing is a line from a Frank Sinatra song. Is that that's a real casual way to end my very last day. Is that like a bad thing? Basically, the chorus is, these will be the last words I will ever sing to make your world a little nicer place. I will quietly go away to south. And basically, the song is about him going to the south.
Right. Yes.
Which I took as like maybe death or something.
Yeah. I either figured it was death or a breakup song. Although it's occurring to me now that it could be a song that maybe lyrically he was in his head when he was like moving off to college or something like that. Kind of the end of a portion of his life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I'll admit my really narcissistic thoughts here. When I was 18 years old, you know, when I was moving away from my hometown, I was done and I was ready to leave. And part of that was just like, I'm done with you people. I'm done with this place. Like, I want to be in a different place and try something different, you know?
Yeah. So it's some kind of change is happening.
Yeah.
And he's basically saying, but it sounded like he's going out in a nice way though. In some ways.
Well, I think it may be sarcastic.
Yeah, he could be. There's definitely sarcasm in this album a lot.
There's too much mystery here to solve it, I think.
And this is also one of the kind of older songs. This song is also on It Might As Well Be Skin, which is like the second Shroud release, I believe. So again, another song that they kind of already had pretty well worked out before they went into the studio. But
and it's a pretty mature song. For being Wall of Sound, there's plenty of things going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say it was like we were almost to the solo before I even started to think maybe I would get bored, and you're not going to get bored during the solo.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of things going on between the vocals and having two guitars, you know, doing different things with the Wall of Sound, and it's the kind of Wall of Sound that I like, where if you're actually patient and listening to it, there's not only multiple things going on, but if you actually let them kind of wash over each other in their layers, there's a lot to hear here.
Yeah. I thought it was a nice kind of second song follow-up from the first one. I think it...
I made a note, though, that if this song had started the album, I probably would have paid more attention to it as a teenager.
Oh, that's funny. I'm the opposite. I love the way the first song is, like, really loud and kind of fast. But
yeah. Because there's no hooks on this album, but I do like a good Wall of Sound, kind of just the way that plays off of it, you know. I talked about that before.
I think you make a good point with the no hooks. Like, you're right. It's melodic in places, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have those super catchy hooks that you know you'd hear from other bands.
Right.
But I feel like this album kind of rewards you for listening more, though. There's a lot here.
Absolutely. And absolutely either this song or Pink Revenge should have been on Hardcore, not the last song.
Fair. Would have would not have hurt them at all. Yeah, it would have
only helped. Yeah.
Let's jump on.
So we're going to skip Champagne at Jay's request. It's a slower song, so I understand that. One other thing I wanted to note, though, is that it has the most listens of any song on Spotify for this album.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. I don't know why.
It would not have been... Okay. Yeah. And to be fair, I kind of thought about doing every song on this, but we decided that was too much. So I was trying to cut this down.
Yeah. So Champagne had to go. Champagne's more atmospheric, but it's a good song. Every song that we're going to skip is good. I'll say that.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, the next song I want to talk about, Bitter Once Again, is not my favorite song musically, but I feel like the lyrics, we just can't.
Yeah.
we got to. But I will say, you know, this song, it starts off with just one guitar, and I probably don't have the right vocabulary for this, but a lot of places in this album, there'll be just one instrument playing. For a minute, and it to me it seems very open. Like, it's kind of a really open sounding album. It's not really afraid of space, and I know that Fugazi is an influence, and actually I'm going to talk more about it later on this song too, but they do that a lot, and so it seems like a natural carryover, because you'll hear various parts on here that are just one instrument before everything else comes in.
Let's listen to the opening here.
We'll be right back.
once it kicks in, it's fairly loud again, but then it mellows way down for the verses.
But it's still Wall of Sound. It's just a more mellow Wall of Sound.
Yeah, the last song kind of stayed fairly loud. This one calms down quite a bit, or at least when he's getting into the verses. This is not as melodic to me, at least, as some of the other songs we're talking about, but I think that the lyrics...
No, but you can understand the lyrics for the most part, and they're very interesting.
Yeah, this is another one that I'm like, what? And we will point out a couple of things. One, this is actually on Candy Darling by The Shroud, that release. The lyrics are slightly different on that one. On that release, it's called And I Say Bitter, where this one is Bitter Once Again. And if you'll notice, if you have the booklet, the lyrics are not included.
No, but it says Bitter Once Again. There's just nothing below them.
Yes, it's funny, huh?
Yeah.
And, you know, on the documentary, they interview Brandon Ebel of Tooth & Nail, and he acts very surprised, like that must have just been a mistake. But it seemed like all the guys were kind of thinking, like, yeah, they did that on purpose.
But he made a good point, which was, if you're going to censor some lyrics in this album, I don't understand why this would be the one, but okay.
Yeah, fair. I was thinking that, too. There's another line in another song coming up, too, that I thought was, like, I don't know how that got through. But yeah. let's go into it. Let me just read a little bit that'll maybe you can see why we're like, okay, we had to talk about these. He says, I know I'll pay for this one since it's over now, I guess. Isn't it such a long way from your head down to your pants? And I say, never look down a girl's shirt because nature will stand in the way. And the chorus is, to use and use better. And then, oh, isn't that what they say? To use and use better, oh, isn't that what they pray? I'm bitter. And I'll just read you the second verse, too, because it's the main parts we're talking about. It says, a small voice sits over us, warning all too small minds. He's cursing the chastity belt, hoping love could be bought. Still, I find, never look down a boy's shirt, because nature will let you down every time. Yeah, so...
And then the chorus is the same thing, basically, but it's inverted, where before, Lee was screaming to use and use better, and someone else was kind of coming in the background saying, oh, isn't that what they say? And this time... someone else says to use and use better, and Lee comes in with, oh, isn't that what they say?
And at the very end, the outro of the song is kind of, you didn't have to be like them, you didn't have to be like them, you didn't have to be like them, but you did, and then I didn't have to be like him, I didn't have to be like him, but I did. I will tell you, Clifton, I hope you haven't looked at my notes yet, because I did figure out a little bit of what this song is about. I do have...
Can I guess?
Yes, please guess first, this will be more fun.
Guilt over sexual infidelity.
Maybe a little bit, yeah. What part's making you think that?
The guilt part.
He doesn't actually say guilt, though.
I know I'll pay for this since it's over now, I guess.
You're right. Okay.
And it's such a long way. It isn't such a long way from your head down to your pants.
Yeah, it's that one's interesting. What do you think he means
which
by...
Which is a great line.
What do you think he means by, and I say, never look down a girl's shirt because nature will stand in the way? Or never look down a boy's shirt because nature will let you down every time.
I think they sound interesting. And I don't know beyond that.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, I was really analyzing this. And the first part when he says never look down a girl's shirt because nature will stand in the way, I thought literally because girls' chests are not flat like boys, that nature was literally standing in the way, like on the shirt touching breast.
Because you were trying to look you're trying to look beyond the breasts.
Right, like nature is literally standing in your way. And then the second part, never looked down a boy's
shirt.
Wait,
but that implies you're not looking at the breasts. Well, sorry, I'm going to have to
just let me fall. But yeah, you're right.
Okay.
But never look down a boy's shirt because nature will let you down every time. Like, oh, there's nothing there. Down sure. a boy's shirt. Now, I was wrong. You'll be, you know, not surprised to find out. Would you like to know what it's about?
Is this from Lee?
Yes.
Okay, and is it from his book? Or
yes.
Okay. I feel like his book is maybe not as honest as I would want it to be.
You're right. And he doesn't say,
whitewash some things here.
He doesn't say nearly enough. And I will say, even on the documentary, he kind of sounds like he's a little bit, what's the right word? Kind of coy about it, I guess, on stuff. Like, yeah. He doesn't really, he's like, oh, really? You thought that? You know, with some of these lyrics.
Yeah, I mean, because one of my notes when I was just thinking back over the album was, this is a very sexual album, right? I know Lee tried to deny it in the documentary, but come on!
Yeah, no, there's like sexuality all in this album, actually in a lot of their stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. I don't want to talk about it more, but here's what he says in the book. He says, it's okay. A song about sexuality, both kinds, of course. The parts about nature will stand in the way and nature will let you down. He said, they refer to erections.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone ever knew that, is what he says, which now, okay, makes a lot more sense. Never look down a girl's shirt, nature will stand in the way. Never look down a boy's shirt, nature will let you down every time. Okay.
Like standing in the way of getting up and walking around?
Yeah, or just mainly like if you look down a girl's shirt, you'll get an erection, is I just thought, you know.
Okay.
If you look down a boy's shirt, you won't. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe just maybe nature is going to stand in the way of being pure of mind then?
I don't even know if he's even worried about that kind of stuff on this. Like,
it doesn't seem like it.
But he
does know that he's going to pay for this.
Right, but I don't even know if he means that for guilt. More is just like, I guess, maybe more sadness that it's over or...
Okay.
You know, I don't know. It's an interesting thing on this album. You're right, though. There's a lot of sexuality, and he doesn't... It's not the normal Christian evangelical look at it. Like, it's...
Agreed. Even though these guys come from a typical evangelical
background. Yes, which is really fascinating to me. I mean, Lee and Jamie's dad was a pastor. They're all at a small right. Christian college. A lot of them said they wanted to be missionaries maybe before they went. So, mm-hmm. But this is, like, very much exploring sexuality, talking about it, like... It's really fascinating. So I don't know. As we kind of close the album, I want to kind of talk more about that once we've done the other songs.
Does he talk about what he means by a small voice sits over us, warning all too small minds?
No. And he talked, you know, obviously he says he's cursing the chastity belt. No, unfortunately, that's about all he says about the song. So I know.
Disappointing.
I know. I thought that was like your conscience or something at first, but then like, why would he be cursing the... That's still,
yeah,
the small voice is cursing the chastity belt.
I'm wondering which direction he's aiming the small minds label, you know?
Yeah.
Is small minds people who think that it's bad to be sexual or people who think that it's okay to be sexual?
I don't even know if he knows, honestly.
All right. It sounds good. Sounds good.
And he says, well, I'm bitter. Is he bitter because of a breakup? What's making him bitter?
I mean, there has to be some kind of outside guilt or shame, I think, for this to make sense to me.
you got very much the evangelical mindset, right? There's got to be guilt or shame. It's got to be there.
Okay, fair.
No, I mean, true. It's what I would have thought too, but yeah. Yeah, I don't know. This is another one of those songs where like these lines are really... It's really interesting that this kind of just slipped through the Christian bookstore, but do you want to talk about the next song?
Yeah, so I do want to mention Vanity. I kind of like the song. It actually has some very interesting background vocals, but we're actually going to see there's something very similar in Flaming Youth, Flames On. So
yeah, and I liked Vanity too, but I just thought we got to cut something. Yeah. And Flaming Youth, Flames On, I mean, just from the title, I'm still thinking some sexuality and stuff, right?
Either that, or I also got like a Japandroids vibe out of it, where like Flaming Youth is more just like a flaming heart type thing, right? Like just it didn't have to be flaming, like flaming
like sexuality. Hearts on fire kind of thing. Like,
yeah, just like excited and full of life, something like that. Could
right.
Be. It could go either way. I don't know.
So I love the way this one starts. It's, and again, my vocabulary for this is probably not going to cover it, but it's got kind of this like undistorted, and I would say almost like jazzy, or like almost like Spanish sounding guitar, kind of like, I don't know, maybe that's not right, but just it's
yeah, I wrote very intrusive trebly jazzy strum guitar intro.
Yeah, and it's got a little bit of a shaker in the background, too. And then short intro of that right before the whole band kicks in. And again, it's got a lot of swagger. It's really good, I think.
Yeah, and it's the most hardcore that we're going to sound on this album.
Yeah.
Like your typical hardcore sound. Like the almost chuggy-chuggy, but not really.
It's the shortest song on the album, too. It, like, wastes no time. The vocals come in pretty quickly. This is not one of those where everything's dragged out. And it stays fast pretty much the whole time. This is actually another song that there's an earlier version of on a split 7-inch with a band called Sunbrain that you can hear on Spotify, actually, under, like, you scroll down. Yeah, and it's very, I mean, the production is not nearly as good on the earlier one, but it's still got that same little beginning guitar riff and everything. So again, it's a pretty formed song before they go into the studio to record this.
Okay.
And I remember when I listened to it, you know, I couldn't make out a lot. I was just like, oh yeah, Flaming Youth, Flames. And then they sing in the background on and on and on, you know.
It's a very, I wrote down, it's kind of a very Hot Water Music-esque song, which is kind of gets into that Fugazi type thing, right? Where they're just taking that Fugazi thing a little bit harder.
Yeah, and funny you mentioned Fugazi, because I want to talk about that in a second. They definitely are copying them on this, and Lee confesses to it.
Well, especially with that background vocals, but yeah.
Yeah. This is, again, another song with quite a few, like, loud drum fills that when you start listening for them, you're like, oh, they're doing quite a bit. On the drums, this is not just a real simple kind of indie rock drumming thing. Got a nice guitar solo on the bridge. And this song kind of, like, to me, it ends before you feel like it actually has to. They don't drag it out at all. It's just like kind of Lee's last lines are, because I'm a little, you know, and he says it very, like, in a sassy way. Which I noted in my notes, I'm like, I don't think we've ever used sassy to describe any of these albums we've covered before at this point.
Lee is definitely sassy.
It fits for this one. and then
did you have the note on, you know?
Yeah.
Did you come across that?
I did. Okay. So the last, well, let's read the lyrics.
Yeah.
Put it in context. So it says this, these are the lyrics. It says, please don't be so mysterious. There isn't time. It's your heart that knows the truth, not your mind, which I love that line. I'm going to read it one more time. It's your heart that knows the truth, not your mind. But you wanted me to please you, to tease you. But words left up to me, they are empty. Sincerity in my hands, you will never understand. And then the chorus is just flaming youth flames on and on and on and on. And it's like background
and the background vocals is that on and on and on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Second verse, when is enough really enough? Could it be too hard to just love me without apologies? And when the end is finally here, will you just let me be nude at last? Which is another line that I'm kind of like, oh, how'd this slip through? Make you gasp, make your heart skip a beat. chorus again, and
there's a lot of rhythm to that, by the way.
Yeah the way he
will you let me just be nude at last,
right? Very again gasp. Very sassy throughout this whole song. And the bridge finally kind of towards the end, he says, I've changed my life for someone else's lies, but no longer, no longer, no longer, no longer. And then at the end, he says, because I'm a little, you know, and he ends it. But actually, supposedly, you know, is supposed to be bastard. I'm a little bastard. But supposedly, we read that Tooth and Nail wanted them to change that.
Right.
Which is, again, funny, like, oh, all the other stuff's in there, but can't have the B word. So what do you think is going on in this song?
I mean, to me, it comes off as kind of like a lover's quarrel of like, just like, maybe not even quarrel, like in the show 30 Rock, they describe a significant other sometimes as a pube shirt. And that's what I feel like here is that this is a kind of just like an uncomfortableness, like of like, being like that teenage feeling that, you know, that you feel like you're being held down by a significant other because you can't be the relationship isn't everything you want it to be, and you don't feel like you can be everything you want to be, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think I definitely could see that, because the last part, it says, I've changed my life for someone else's lies, but no longer, mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm moving past this. You're not letting me be myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm moving on.
Right.
So I will tell you a little bit about what he says, and you, and where some of the influence on the song is. He said, this is from the book, we wrote Flaming Youth Flames On in the unfinished dirt basement of Chris's house in Cornelia. Chris and I had been playing a sort of jazzy tune based on the chords. We played together a few times, but nothing was there. It was slow and formless. Late in the evening, I pulled out Fugazi's In on the Kill Taker and had an idea after listening to Smallpox Champion, the song. We did our best to ape that song. I really like that song. It was fervent and eager and had a nice switch to it in the middle. And he says, I really like that song. He said, I really like that song twice in just a few lines. And if you listen to the Fugazi song at first, you're going to probably be like, huh? But there's a couple places, and the song is called Smallpox Champion. And in that song, he says, champion, like that. And I think that's definitely where they kind of got some of the like, on and on, like some of the mm-hmm. repetition in the song. And it is a loud song. It's Fugazi's song.
Yeah.
But yeah, this maybe is maybe one of Luxury's loudest songs ever.
Yes.
This and the first one, Pink Revenge.
And I found this performed a few times. It's on YouTube, a few live performances, all the way from like 97 at I don't know where they were. In fact, it's a venue I recognize from the documentary. To a 2001 or 2002, something like that, Cornerstone, and then yet even more recent performance, and it's always the last song of the show.
Ah, okay.
Which is interesting because, like you said, it ends before it feels like it needs to be.
Yeah.
And so when it's the last song, you kind of just like, you're kind of like just like just almost like a jerking stop. You know, you're like, wait, what? Nope, more.
I love this song. It's the one I remembered the most by them because, like I said, I think it was the first song on the second side of the tape.
Mm-hmm. This would be a very interesting album if it was arranged like that, where if the second half of the album was the first half and the first half of the album was the second.
Well, and I do feel like this album, especially if you include When the Curtain Falls, mm-hmm. it feels like it slows down a bit on the second half
yes.
of the album. And I think as a kid, I remember kind of being like, okay, skip, zone out, skip, you know, kind of thing. But some of these songs are pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you want to go on? We're going to skip, I guess, two of them now.
Yeah. I really liked I Know What You Think About Me. That's all I have to say mm-hmm. about it. I just really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. I like the Luxury theme too, mm-hmm. which is also an older song that's on one of their earlier right. releases. But for the sake of this, because our podcasts are already too long, you know, we've got to move on.
Skip on to Kill the Famous.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I also just like the title. I like the lyrics. I mean, anytime somebody's belting out Kill the Famous, to me, is just fun.
Although I think they might arrive at a different conclusion by the end of it.
But you're okay. Right, I know. But this is one that also, to me, sounds very open, kind of. It starts off just with drums, and mm-hmm. then the bass and guitar come in. And it does not get in a hurry. The vocals don't come in until about a minute in the song. And this is definitely kind of like a song that really builds. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't kind of get loud until the chorus. And in fact, the first time after the first verse, they kind of go into a pre-chorus and you think, oh, here it goes. And then they quiet back down and go back into another verse.
Yeah, my first note of the song is OJ left in a slow song. That's good. And then by the end of it, I was like, wait, was this a slow song?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when he gets to the chorus, this is, in my opinion, on this album, the closest you get to like an anthem because he just is kind of really belting out Kill the Famous. To me, this is the most kind of sing along of all the songs on here, just because the way the chorus is pretty clear and anthemic. It goes back soft again after the chorus. And I'll say, not that you really should use this term for this album, but if you're going to call a song like emo on this album, it might be this one because it's got a lot of that soft, loud dynamic.
I agree. Yeah. But it's not, but you're right. It is a little like.
Yeah, it's the closest maybe to that. And the bridge has this line, the famous, they are naturally bad. That's a fun one to sing along to.
Are you sure it's not the famous, are they naturally bad?
Oh, maybe. We'll have to look at the lyrics, but I like saying they are naturally bad.
All right, I'm looking at the lyrics right now. They're hard to read on this.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's another thing. The lyrics in the booklet are almost impossible to read.
So what do you think is up with the gold ring and stuff like that in this song?
Let's talk about the lyrics. It says, I'll read you some. The voice you hear is not my singing. The voice you hear is not my singing voice, but instead it's just a voice inside my head. It's where I can say all those brilliant, brutal words, brutal, brilliant words that can never be said, such as, and he says, and I would give my life just to have your diamond smile because it's gotten you where you are every mile. That is just your dark talent, a pinky full of real talent. Hooray, 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 I'm jealous of you again. And then he belts into Kill the Famous, all that. And then he says, kill the calm ones, your famous lips. They say, hey, son, you can wear the ring. It's as good as gold. It's a proven thing. But lead me not in temptation, whether sweet or sour, I'm sure to give it. Hooray, hooray, hooray. I'm someone else again. Kill the famous. And he says, your legs, your lips, kill the famous. And you're right. And the famous, they aren't naturally bad. Oh, I love saying they are naturally bad. Oh, well, has anyone ever been naturally bad? The famous, they aren't naturally bad. Has anyone ever been naturally bad? No. Your famous lips.
Can I just say, what a weird song?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's weird. A lot of these, when you read the lyrics without the music, you're like, I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
It's real weird. Huh? Yeah, especially this one. In his book, he says, Kill the Famous is a fine song that Jamie wrote as well. And the lyrics aren't half bad. Maybe Jamie wrote the lyrics. I don't know. I was listening to a lot of the Beautiful South, and somehow that played a part in the imagery about rings and gold. So I don't know the Beautiful South, but evidently it's another band he liked that sang a lot about that.
Okay.
Which you also see in what is sort of the last song on the album, Solid Gold. He also talks kind of about rings and gold and stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Any other thoughts on Kill the Famous?
I mean, like, there's some really weird things going on here. It's not just your famous lips. It's hips, eyes, lips, or hips, legs, lips.
Yeah.
And then we get famous lips several times. We get hurrah. Hurrah is not the first time this album hurrah has shown up, by the way.
Right.
And then I think the thing we can talk about the most is just that, once again, how did this not get more attention in the Christian market? Which, has anyone been naturally bad? No.
Yeah.
That, so there's no such thing as original sin, guys? Luxury?
Well,
you're bad. You're a bad Christian band.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's kind of a theme I feel like that you see with luxury starting here to, like, the present. Like, I feel like their view of humanity is not the normal Christian evangelical. And I think that even shows up now with Lee being a priest. You know, one of the more recent, like, albums he put out solo is called The Majesty of the Flesh. And one thing that he's kind of talked about in interviews is that, you know, in evangelical Christianity, there's always this separation of, like, the spirit and the flesh. You know, the spirit is willing, the flesh is weak, and all this stuff. And that, I kind of view that always as a little bit like original sin, right? Like, people are born bad, and it's our spirit that's trying to guide us towards good, but our flesh is trying to guide us towards evil. And he basically says, no, we're all one thing, and we're good. Like, it's all one thing. It's made by God. It's good. Our body is a whole. It's one thing, and we should think of it in a good way, which I personally like that view a lot more.
But then where's the guilt?
Exactly. That's what I mean. It's not really on this album, which kind of blows my mind, because they're not even really orthodox yet.
Right.
And yeah, this is not, doesn't really have any of the typical Christian tropes at the time or any of those things you see, but in some ways seems very mature in their thinking about things.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. Like, has anyone ever been naturally bad? No. Where, yeah, at this time, everybody, yeah, of course you are. Everybody's naturally bad. You need Jesus.
Yeah, it's very curious, and I don't know how this didn't get more attention.
I know.
Just, they weren't popular enough to get attention.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, in the lyric book, a lot of these lyrics are not super easy to read, and
yeah,
the way they're kind of put in here, and some of them, like, the background is the same color, and it's just,
I mean, reading those, I was trying to read those lyrics, it was pretty hard.
Yeah, I had to look them up online, because I was like, I can't do it in the lyric book. Well, want to go to the last, sort of the last song on the album? It's the last official song, but then there's two others that they basically tacked on the end.
All right, Solid Gold.
It starts just with a guitar and, like, a shaker or maybe bells, and it's very slow. And again, it's very kind of open, spacey sounding. And he starts off by singing, Wedding Bells Are Here Again. And this is also, like, kind of like Kill the Famous, is a really slow building song. I don't think the drums really kick in until about 2.5 minutes into the song. One thing they do in this that's different than some other songs is they kind of have some harmonizing in the chorus. Kind of the chorus is, how uneasy lays the head that wears the crown, which is from Shakespeare, Henry IV. Which is kind of we'll talk about it. It's kind of a weird thing to say in the song, I think. I'm not exactly sure what he means by this. But this song builds and builds and builds, and it's not until about 5 minutes in that the distortion kicks in and builds to nothing, And then drums, and then how on it, you know, he gets loud again and goes back into it. So it's kind of a cool song to end with if it was the actual real last song. Some interesting trivia. I read that Jason Martin of Starfire 59 actually had this song played at his wedding.
Really?
And some other people have also mentioned they had it.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem a very marriage positive song.
Well, that's okay. So I'm with you on that because, yeah, he says basically, you know, wedding bells are here again and the weight of love to entertain again with untouched hands holding golden bands. Nothing's the way it was yesterday. Nothing's the way it was yesterday. Oh, I mean, okay. So far, all right, whatever. He says, Lady Luck has her hand stretched out for me and I take it with uncertainty. Fate has brought us together, says I. Your place or mine, she replies, which also is a little racy for the time. And then he says, so what do you expect from life? What do you expect from life? And then he just says, oh, how uneasy lays the head that wears the crown. And then they kind of move into having to hold solid gold. And that's kind of the end of the song, you know, repeating that. But the way I take how uneasy lays the head that wears the crown is basically like, talking about a king, right? And all the responsibility on their shoulders and kind of like, oh man, this is a big decision marriage. Are you ready?
Right. I kind of read that in contrast with the weight of love to entertain again. Is the word entertain there, is it saying, should I consider love, or is it saying that love needs to entertain? Like, keep us amused.
Right. Good point.
I don't know how to read that.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah, it's interesting. I like it. I like the sound of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice the way it kind of kicks back up at the end. I'm not super clear what he's meaning. I'll tell you one other thing he says. This is from the book. He says, writing Solid Gold took a little time. Musically, it was simple, but lyrically, I had to do some research. I lived a short while in Grant Park in Atlanta, and my friend Matt had a book of Latin sayings that might be useful. Flipping through the book, I found the two sayings I eventually used in the song. I think those were the seeds that germinated the whole thought. It was a love song as well. He said, I married Amy not long after I wrote the song, or maybe just before. And there are all sorts of conflicts I had in my own mind about romance and love and relationships bound up in it. I am sure I took the title from the hit show in the 1980s with all the dancers. And the line about the head and the crown was stolen from somewhere. No idea now.
Yeah.
It's a good song. It's a nice way to end the album. But then there's actually two songs after that. One called Rockstar that Jamie kind of sings on, which... it's not bad, but it feels out of place, especially between Solid Gold and then the last song, which is, you know, When the Curtain Falls. And so I don't know where else you would put it, but it feels out of place because it's a lot more upbeat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Overall, I think this is a really good album and really feel like it was kind of ahead of its time and really just out of place at its time. You know, again, it's like the 16th release on Tooth and Nail. And that was the only label this was even close to fit on in the Christian market. But it really probably shouldn't have been. I listened to a podcast with the drummer, and he said his biggest regret was signing with Tooth and Nail.
Yeah.
And I think maybe had they waited longer and tried, maybe if they'd been on like Merge or Matador or Sub Pop or something, like it could have gone a lot better for them and a lot differently.
Yeah. And it's not like the infrastructure wasn't there. They're in Toccoa Falls, which is kind of a suburb of Atlanta, kind of northeast of Atlanta. It's no further from Atlanta than Athens is, Athens, Georgia. It's just Athens is straight east, and Toccoa is kind of northeast. So they're close to Atlanta. They're close to Athens. I don't understand. There's plenty of infrastructure there for music. You know, why did they sign to the first label that offered them a deal at Cornerstone? I guess is my
question. In some ways, I think it's almost like a different understanding of like Christianity. And maybe I'm making too much of it, especially now that they're priests. But again, it's like they were looking at things from a very, very different point of view.
Yeah.
Where Tooth and Nail, as much as it was different, is still very much in that kind of evangelical world. It was just like the cool side of it, the little more, you know, artsy, rebellious, whatever side of it. But yeah, still in that world where I feel like this is just something completely, like, at least lyrically, right, completely different.
And, you know, in that, I think that maybe, you know, Grey Dot makes more sense a little bit, like, especially, like, with this seems more in line with, like, Loudflower's understanding of Christianity, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, Tooth and Nail, while being a little edgier, is still solidly evangelical Christian as much as the Newsboys are.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that seems like a bad fit to me. Not to mention the fact that Tooth and Nail just didn't do anything at all to push them.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is, too, this came out too early on Tooth and Nail. I think if this had come out, like, 97, maybe this would have gotten a little more... Because there was a point when I felt like Tooth and Nail was getting a little bit more respect in the major market with, like,
sure,
that Danielson Family album, the Roadside Monument album. Like, some of the others were kind of pushing the limits a little more, and people were paying attention. So maybe it would have done better then, but...
They did have an album that came out in 97, and the song that got put on the rock sampler is the... an out-of-place poppy song.
Good point.
That sounds honestly more like Delta Amax than it does Luxury.
Okay, yeah, good
point. And that's fine. It's a great song, and it's one of those treasures that makes that rock sampler amazing, but it's not how you market Luxury.
Yeah. I also think Luxury seemed like a band that needed to be seen live, and so then, of course, with that accident,
yeah,
and then just kind of after that being older and kind of settling down more, they couldn't tour like they probably needed to break to the next level.
Probably so. And there's also the question of, does a band like that needs to be seen live, are they even going to survive? You know, was the market past that? You know, we were no longer in the days of Led Zeppelin, you know, so.
Yeah. And
was that just.
Well, they're also limited. Because, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, think about those lyrics. Think about how kind of sassy he is. And from the clips we've seen, it seems like Lee really embodied that on the stage. In fact, they got a second guitar player later so that he could stop playing guitar and move around more. But imagine that, like, in a church sanctuary, right? Which they probably played on some of these tours because they're on Tooth and Nail. Like, I just, yeah, wow.
Right. Whereas, like, the edgy stuff on Tooth and Nail can still tour with the Newsboys. In fact, did tour with the Newsboys.
Yeah.
And this, you can't see these guys opening up for Newsboys. You know, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, I love thinking about Luxury now, because, you know, they're still together, even though it's, you know, they're all kind of living different places, but they're still putting out music.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it still is kind of like, it's not as raw maybe as this, but it's got some of those same themes of sexuality and some of these other things. Mm-hmm. But three of them are priests. Like, I just, it kind of blows your mind because, again, maybe they are the most Christian band that we've covered so far at the same time.
Just in a different way.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff we're talking about doesn't seem to be Christian at all. It really is a lot to think about.
Well, I mean, the Orthodox, you know, understanding of Christianity is fundamentally different than the Western understanding, I think, in general. You know, I mean, the split there was, you know, far preceded the Protestant split from the Catholic Church. You know, I mean, this is fundamental, goes back to single digit centuries. I don't remember exactly when the split was, but like, what, 600, something like that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know either, but you're right, like, way, way, way back.
So, you know, they have a lot of, their understanding of Christianity is very different. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of things that become part of our culture wars and part of our fundamental guilt, you know, theology isn't there for them to hook on to these days. But that's not true back then. These guys were still evangelical, even if they had a slightly different understanding of it.
I read an interesting essay that somebody wrote about kind of Luxury and compared them to, like, David Bazan from Pedro the Lion, and how they both kind of were clearly questioning, you know, a lot of the evangelical culture at the time and frustrations with it, and how they both kind of went completely different directions out of that, but that it both seems right for both of them. And I think in a way, like, it's kind of beautiful how they, because they talk about all like, their frustrations in the Christian scene, but they were able to kind of get past that, and, you know, three of them become Orthodox priests. It's kind of amazing when you think about it, because I can only just imagine the frustrations, both with trying to play at their college, which I know at a certain point they were no longer allowed to play there.
Right, yeah. Get kicked out of there.
You know, yeah. And then just also all these shows and dealing with the Christian world, to be able to kind of make it through that and have a better understanding of, you know, who they view God to be and all that. That's that's nice.
And, you know, something that never came up in the documentary is, you know, after that crash, and like you said, being fundamentally a live band, they kind of grew up and settled down a little bit, but at the same time, was there anxiety about getting back on the road?
I mean, it's a great question. I know they did do one more tour. I would think so. Just getting in a van with all those people, like, my gosh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, overall, a really pretty good album. I listened to this one probably more than any other one we've had so far in preparation for this, because I felt like there was just kind of a lot to discover on it.
There is, yeah. So what'd you think about the documentary overall?
I really liked it in learning about luxury. I definitely came out of that going, man, I want to listen to that band. It like made me really want to explore all of their catalog, not just this album. I really, really liked that part of it. And it was fun seeing like some guys from the Prayer Chain and Mark Solomon and some other people I kind of recognized in the documentary talking about them. I thought he did a really good job of getting a lot of different perspectives. Again, understanding that they were really a good live band, I had no idea of that till I saw it. I guess my biggest criticism, and again, I liked the documentary, so take it, you know, this is just a part to be critical of, is I wanted to know a little bit more about why they became priests, and I don't feel like that was completely ever answered in it. He did a good job of showing them as priests and the different style of life and talking about all that, but I wanted to kind of know more like why, like what pushed them into that. And they touch on it a little bit, but I felt like that could have been clearer.
Yeah. And even in, did you send it to me or did I find it where that thing, that write up by Lee about why he was going to seminary? And even in that, he's very kind of vague about how, you know, the Eastern Orthodox offers a better understanding and a better worldview basically than evangelical Christianity, but he's kind of just vague about it. He's just like, it's better.
I think when you kind of unpack the lyrics, and like we talked about before, you kind of get a sense of maybe why they embrace that worldview more. But you know, overall, I definitely think the documentary is worth watching. And I noticed it has pretty good score on Rotten Tomatoes, like 80-something%. So it's not just people who knew the band. These are people that have never knew nothing about luxury, enjoyed it quite a bit. So if you have not seen it, it's now on, I think I rented it on Amazon Prime or something. I think you can get it on, you know, Apple and some of the other places. It's out there everywhere now. So it's called Parallel Love. Go watch it. It's very good. I think if you're listening to the podcast, you'll probably like it.
I don't know if there's a physical copy of it, but you can get anywhere that you can basically buy or rent digitally.
Yeah, it's out there.
I thought the last third was a little slow.
Yeah.
When they got into the priesthood thing, you know.
That's what I mean. I feel like it could have maybe done that a little better. I will say one request. I wish they would put out more of the live footage of them that they used from the documentary. Mm-hmm. Like if they have any full, at least songs or shows, put that up on YouTube or something. Cause I kept looking for it, cause I wanted to see those more of those clips, and it's not there. Okay. Clearly the band or somebody has it, but it's not anywhere that anyone else can really see it. Cause there's not a lot of them before like maybe 96 or 97 online. It'd be nice to see some of those really early shows.
And I found one or two songs from 97 on one of the band members' YouTube pages. I don't remember which one. If you just search luxury and the song titles, you'll find them. But that's all. I looked at their entire YouTube page and they had six videos in total, you know, and two of them were from 97. That's it. That's the earliest you can find. Do you have anything to add for Where Are They Now?
I mean, I think you know most of it. Jamie and Lee, the brothers, are both Orthodox priests, along with Chris Foley. I think Lee's in Texas. I think Chris is maybe in North Carolina, and I'm not sure where Jamie is, somewhere maybe on the East Coast as well. Glenn, the drummer, he has epilepsy, and actually he started having seizures when they were in the band. I know that now he's actually was able to retire early because of that, which he said has kind of been nice. He's been able to work on the band stuff more since then, but I believe he lives in North Carolina. They did add a fifth member, I guess I should mention, named Matt, who's actually the director of the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be in that band Piltdown Man, which is the band they were on tour with when they had the bad accident in 95. So he's kind of been like a longtime friend of theirs anyway. And I think they added him in 1999 again so that the Lee could perform
prance around the stage more.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think they just enjoyed having another guitarist.
Yeah. And stuff. So no, I mean, their music requires more guitars.
Yeah, yeah. He's been a member since then. But no, I mean, their last album is called Trophies. It officially, I think it came out to the Kickstarter people in 2015, but it kind of got a bigger release in 2019 when the film came out. Right. And it's good. Like, you should listen to it. They've grown a lot as a band, but it's not nearly as rough sounding as this, but it's still good. In fact, I'll be honest, I'm probably going to be listening to Luxury a lot more after, after this. Yeah,
and Lee has some solo stuff, which is good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed. Yeah,
like if you're a fan of Luxury, they've done a good job of putting like everything on Bandcamp. Mm-hmm. So yes, they have, in one form or fashion, Luxury people were in like this. They were in, I think they were in They Sang as They Slew. They were in All Things Bright and Beautiful. There's like a ton. Like you could spend a week or two and not ever hear the same song twice listening to all the stuff they've got up on Bandcamp and linked to the band.
Yeah.
So there's a ton there.
Do you have a reward or an award for this album?
You know, I was thinking about it, Clifton. I was on a walk today and I was trying to think about it. I don't know, maybe the sexiest album. I don't
know. It is the sexiest album. I will agree with that.
Okay.
The
sexiest album so far.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Okay. All right, this is the sexiest album so far. Probably will be the sexiest album we ever cover, but you never know.
I like it. What are we listening to on the next episode?
We are listening to, and I apologize if I don't say this correctly, Black Eyed Siva, 5 years, 50,000 miles, Davis EP, 1996, 5 minute walk record.
I listened to this so much, and this was, and I felt so mature when I listened to it in high school because this was college rock, as far as I understood it.
Wait, so you remember it being called that?
Uh-huh.
Oh, so you're like, oh, I'm listening to college rock.
Yeah. 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 16-year-old Clifton was very proud of himself for listening to college rock. And that's how HM defined it, I think. So
okay, yeah. Well, yeah, you were correct.
I really like this though. There's gonna be a lot to talk about here because it's the music is great and the lyrics are interesting. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Your Music Saved Us.
If you enjoyed your time with us, please leave us a review or share this episode. Visit our website, yourmusicsavedus.com, to find out all the ways to listen. We're on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Join our Facebook group or follow us to keep up with the latest or interact with us. Send complaints and disagreements to yourmusicsavedus@gmail.com.
The music in this episode is the work of Luxury and is used with apologies, not permission.
And you can find lots of Luxury's music on Bandcamp, and we highly recommend going there and buying it and supporting the band. And go watch that documentary.
Yep, rent or buy the documentary. And there, where'd you find the book, Jay?
Lulu.com. LULU.com. Lee has put out this one, and he's got another one that is kind of about his solo stuff and writings and things like that. So,
what's it called?
This one is called Strange Flowers, and I do not remember what his solo one is called, but if you just look for Lee Bozeman on there, or just probably Bozeman, you will find it. And if you're a massive Luxury fan, you will probably enjoy it, because it's got chord progressions for all the songs too, so you can play them on your own.
Cool. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Bye.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
That was a fun album.
Yeah, that was good. It was weird to not really have so many like criticisms.
Yeah.
So I may be wrong on this, and someone listening, please correct me if so, but I think the woman that's on the CD, that's an actual photo, she's also on the back cover of the album. Hmm. I think that is... At this point, I think her name was Julie Musali or Musali. She married Jason Martin. I think that is Jason Martin's wife. She's also in Bon Voyage later.
Yeah.
And it just looks very similar to me. Matt Wignall from Javelina did the layout for this, like he did for a ton of the early Tooth and Nail stuff.
Okay.
She also sang in Javelina with him at the time, so it's not a stretch. And so that's my guess. If anybody knows for sure, would love to know, but that's who I think that is.
Do you remember Joe Club?
No.
Do we have them on here?
What? Hey, your tabs are like mine. All right, I don't feel so bad.
Oh, and I have like three windows open that also have more tabs.